already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly, terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to Treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former Prime Minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 23rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
And it's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counterstrike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China.
Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex.
Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Esam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government, based in the capital Sana'a, has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We could only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020, and as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda. The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, than fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Last week, Peru's President Pedro Castillo was removed from office. His charge, quote, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress. Enter Castillo's Vice President Dina Boluarte, who was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what has happened in Peru and whether the U.S., who has shown support for the coup and the new president, had any role in it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Arnold August joins us. He's an author and journalist from Montreal. Also joining us is Libra Sankar, who's a contributor at the Troika Collective, joining us from Miami.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Libra Sankara, I'll start with you. If you can please tell us, in so many words, what has happened in Peru? What did Pedro Castillo do to be dealt the harsh hand that he has been dealt with at this point?
So what we have happening in Peru is not anything new to the history. Peruvian politics have unfortunately developed into what is happening today. So what happens? Pedro Castillo represents the indigenous community. He comes from a working class background. And he represents a move towards a Peru that acknowledges the role of working class people, of indigenous people, and so he poses a threat to the working class, or he poses a threat to the far right people that come from like Fujimori and the Fujimoristas. He also was pushing for a new constitution, which is one of the platforms that he ran on and got high approval for. And so Pedro Castillo represents what the far right fears, which is Peru moving towards a working class politic that benefits the working class people of Peru and the indigenous people of Peru. And this is a very scary thing, which is why a coup has been orchestrated. What Pedro Castillo was pushing for in dissolving Congress is nothing new. In fact, the president prior to him did it, and many other presidents have done it. It's part of their constitution that a president can dissolve Congress if they feel they're not able to move forward. And so Pedro Castillo, unfortunately, is part of a larger plan to continue destabilizing Peru so that U.S. corporations and people like the U.S. ambassador can continue to take advantage of the of Peru as a mineral-rich country and a country that is full of working-class people.
Okay, very good. We're going to get to some of those points a little later, but first, trying to understand how Peru has unraveled at the speed that it has, Arnold August. And our guests there mentioned something that is very key in this, and that is the fact that, you know, this is not anything new, what Pedro Castillo did, which was, in essence, to be more concrete here, it was Article 134 that is something that he enacted, which was only going to be a temporary closure from what we understand, in which the president said new congressional elections would then be held as soon as possible. So are we to take the fact that what was then done to him was part of, as our guests are mentioned, of a bigger plan to oust him?
Yes, of course. I'm quite sure right after he got elected, I'm sure that the United States and their allies in Europe and Canada started to go into action in order to plan what we call lawfare, that is using juridical or so-called legal means to overthrow the elected president. And, you know, we just discussed, you know, the question of the United States' role. I mean, the day before his arrest and the coup took place, the day before, the American embassy in Peru actually met with the opposition. So they are directly involved in that. And I think that the fact that he dissolved the Congress, I perfectly believe it is a correct decision, while some, you know, middle-of-the-roaders are saying, well, we oppose what happened to him, but the fact that he dissolved the Congress was not right. It was right, because right now, who has the last word on this? It should be the people in the streets. And the people in the streets in Peru right now are calling for a constituent assembly. That is to replace that Congress. So that decision was right, I think, legally, morally, and also historically, because it opens up a new path for the people in the street. And we saw, when we discuss these type of governments before at Press TV, I always presented the position that we could not, you know, whether it's the left, part of the left tide or not, I always was always of the opinion we cannot concentrate on the personalities who won elections, for example, Boric in Chile, and now Castillo in Peru. What we have to look at is the larger picture. Where did Castillo come from? He came from a mass movement of indigenous workers. He himself is a teacher. And that what brought him into power. And that is why on the ground now, that you were talking about the left, the pink tide. The pink tide in Peru is happening right now.
Indeed. Well, tell us your reaction, if you can, Libra Sankara, to the move that the VP, Dina Boluarte, made and then became the president, where she accused the president of, the former, I don't want to call him the former president, but it appears that way for now, Castillo, of a coup attempt. And then basically it just happened a few hours later, from what we understand, where she became the president. She was sworn in. I mean, why would she be the one chosen for this, do you think? And at this point, obviously, we're seeing the backlash on the streets. So is that a miscalculation on the part of the grand scheme of things?
I think what we have is betrayal. The ambassador of the U.S. met with Dina Boluarte, the so-called president of Peru. And given the trajectory of Peruvian politics, it's also highly unlikely that she herself is going to last until the 2026 elections. And again, Pedro Castillo is the only democratically elected president. The people did not elect Dina Boluarte to lead them. And I think this speaks to the move and the direction that Peru was trying to go into. The comrade just spoke about pink tide. And I think what we see happening in Latin America right now is the U.S. trying to impose unipolarity. And we see a pink tide 2.0 coup and coup attempts. This is happening in Peru. They're using lawfare in Argentina. And they're trying to do another coup in Bolivia. And all these happen to be countries that are moving further to the left. So Dina Boluarte is just a pawn in the larger grand scheme of the U.S. trying to maintain its exploitative relationship to countries like Peru, that if they are to develop for the Peruvian masses of people, the indigenous Peruvians, the working class Peruvians, that Peru could in fact stand on its own two feet and not have to be dependent on the U.S. In this very parasitic, exploitative relationship. And Europe is just as guilty in this as well. Europe is guilty because they're playing more of the corporate side of things. Their corporations, the mining, are all corporations that are in Europe, and as well as the U.S. It's kind of like a joint venture.
So many people have referred to the EU being a vassal state of the U.S. But let's look into the situation more with the U.S. interference, Arnold August, as both of you have indicated that that occurred. Now, Arnold August, you said that just a day earlier, before this went down, you had the U.S. ambassador meet with the opposition. We also understand that a day before, this U.S. ambassador, who is a former CIA agent, also met with, the defense minister, from what we understand, a retired brigadier general, which then, we understand, he ordered the military to turn against Castillo. So this is not something that has happened in a matter of just 24, 48 hours. As both of you have indicated, in a sense, this is a scheme, a plan that the U.S., in conjunction with different players within Peru's political apparatus, had planned before. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And you and our guest just mentioned the United States and other actors such as Europe. Allow me to point out to another actor that is much more vigorous in support of the coup than the Europeans, and that is Canada. You know, Canada is right from the start took the following position, saying they issued a one-sentence statement saying Canada would like to express its deep concern over Castillo's attempt to dissolve Congress and establish a government of exception in Peru. Such destabilizing actions risk jeopardizing Peru's adherence to democracy. And if that is not enough, another statement from Canada came out the day later. Canada calls for calm and invites all actors. That's a very famous line from Canada, all actors. When the revolt was taking place in Chile a couple of years ago, and it was obvious the use of the army and the Carabineros in actually killing and maiming people, they always call for all actors to avoid tensions and all that. Now, I cannot help myself to make the comparison. While Trudeau, the Trudeau government, jumps right from start one, run from game one, the first day, in opposing the demonstrations of millions of people in Peru, indigenous workers, against the coup. In Iran, they support the U.S.-led riots that are taking place in Iran. So I think it's important for people to really have a good grasp of the dirty role that Canada plays through Justin Trudeau as the most faithful ally of U.S. imperialism, not only in Latin America, but internationally.
Sure. Well, they have played destructive roles when we go through the different actions that have been executed, with the U.S. being in the lead in many of them. But before we get to that, let's look at some of the reactions, Libre Sankara, of Latin American leaders, because you have many of the governments. At last count, there were seven of them, where you have Mexico, Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Cuba, and some other nations at this point, who have criticized and refused to recognize Peru's unelected coup regime, as they have called it. Is that going to make a difference in the fate of Peru and where it's headed when you have this opposition of this magnitude?
I think what it symbolizes is a shift towards multipolarity, a shift away from U.S. Imperialism and its role in Latin America in general. I think things like this will become more frequent. I don't know that it will have tangible presence in Peru itself. I think the Peruvian people, the ronderos that come from these indigenous communities that helped to have this historical victory to elect Pedro Castillo as president, I think between them and Peru Libre and other left factions in Peru will ultimately play the most important roles. But I think what these statements help do is to help the Peruvian people understand that they have the solidarity of other countries. I don't know that these countries are going to send any real firm resources to help help Peruvians fight against this. But I also see countries like Mexico trying to talk with the government to offer Pedro Castillo asylum. In fact, when he realized what was happening, he tried to go to the Mexican embassy, and he was barred from doing that by his security detail, and shortly after he was detained. And so we have to be very vigilant of what's going to continue to happen. Unfortunately, more Peruvians are going to be killed because, again, they democratically elected Pedro Castillo. They want him in office. They are going out into the streets, but this is being met by the far right that has no problem killing people, that has no problem harming its own citizens to maintain its own greedy benefit that these far-right Fujimorista type of people hope to continue. They want to continue being in positions of power and exploiting their own people and getting business deals. And so the seven countries, and I'm sure there will be more to follow, are simply showing their solidarity with the working class people. Hopefully that shows up in tangible ways. But as in the foreseeable future, it doesn't look like they're going to send any material things. This is symbolic, and it's helpful to build morale, but that's about it.
Okay, well, Arnold August, our guest, also mentioned the pink tide. And we've seen what has happened in the past couple of years in terms of the political landscape that is characterized by the term pink tide, where you have these left-wing presidents to pretty much come into power, because they are the ones that actually represent the true people out in the broad economy and society of the different countries that they represent. I mean, one of the most, prolific ones would be the Brazilian President Lula da Silva that came out in some sense, and him winning the presidency was very was an eye-opener, I would guess, from the U.S. perspective, because he made one announcement, and that was how he wants there to be a move away from the dollar. He wants the local economies of each country to deal in their national currencies. Are we looking at this to have ticked off the U.S., this new wave of left-wing presidents, as they say, and therefore they are now counter-reacting to that?
Yes, I would say so. I just add, you, both of you rightly mentioned all of the presidents and leaders of the Latin American countries that took a firm stand publicly in support of Castillo. I would add one other bloc that just came out, I think, yesterday, and that is ALBA, which includes many countries, including in the small Caribbean island. In terms of the current situation, I think aside from what happened to Cristina Kirchner a couple of weeks ago, this attempt here is the first attempt of a coup since the election of Lula in Brazil. You know, I think that is going to make a big difference. Brazil, of course, as everyone knows, it's a major player in Latin America, and through BRICS, it has important ties with other important countries such as China, India, South Africa, and Russia. And the way China is now increasingly making its presence felt on the international scale with regards to other countries, for example, just a few days ago, making a clear statement in support of the right of Palestine to its own state with its capital in East Jerusalem. The United States might have some surprises, as not only the countries in Latin America that perhaps feel more confident, more bold since the election of Brazil, but even internationally, this may build up further, and it may be a very hard situation for the United States and its allies to face while Castillo is in prison, and everyone is against that in Peru and many countries of the world, not only in Latin America.
Okay. The fact that you came out right away pretty much, Libra Sankar, and talked about how you have Castillo that represents the indigenous population there in Peru, and the fact that he is the one that was able to edge out in the vote because he had the common people be on his side. Tell us the way that this has backfired for the ones that were in control of the major industries and how they felt threatened. And perhaps, given the fact that they have connections, and I'm just making the connection here, and whether it's accurate or not, it's up for you to tell us. And that these, for example, we know that Castillo brought in a lot of new ministers, and I'm guessing just that fact itself might have threatened the livelihoods of some of these people who I don't know if I want to call them oligarchs or not, but you know, the ones that were in power in different sectors and fields of the economy. And therefore, they obviously sided with the motion to try to oust Castillo. And that's where the U.S. connection also comes in, because you have Peru that has a lot of important natural resources, gold being the number one, from what I understand, natural resource of Peru. Is that a correct reading into this?
Yeah, that is an accurate reading. And in fact, I mean, Peru, since the colonial times, has been taken advantage of by foreign interests. And so what Castillo represents is indigenous working class, right? Like, this is somebody that when they were giving speeches, they spoke in the indigenous language, which brought a lot of the elected officials to anger, because their status quo is to speak Spanish, to kind of take on this more, it's not educated to speak like that, and this demonization of indigenous people in a country that's mostly indigenous, they just until Pedro Castillo were not in positions of power. They weren't being appointed, their perspectives were not being brought into policies, their perspectives were not being brought into the proposed new constitution. Which is something that has also been happening during the peak tide. A lot of these left governments have been rewriting their constitutions or codifying new laws. For example, Cuba just passed its family codes, and Chile, unfortunately, didn't vote, but they were looking to rewrite their own constitution. And so Pedro Castillo also represents and came from the Peru Libre Party, which, you know, he appointed a Marxist-Leninist in his cabinet, which unfortunately the individual had to step down because shortly after being being put into his position, he got death threats. And this just shows how status quo the career politicians want to keep Peru. Again, Peru, with such rich economy and such such access to resources, has been a country that has been overexploited and underdeveloped. And this works to the benefit of these career politicians and to foreign interests instead of the interests of Peruvians. And so Pedro Castillo represented and still represents a move towards a new type of Peru, a Peru that is moving left and closer to a Peru for Peruvians themselves. And so this scares people that don't want that to be the reality because it doesn't benefit their pockets. Okay. And so that's why millions of Peruvians are out in the streets protecting and asking for his release.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, a pleasure. And Libra Sankara, thank you. Contributor at the Troika Collective from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
In the U.S., a key witness has told the House Select January 6th committee that a lawyer linked to Donald Trump tried to silence her. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered this story. The Trump-aligned lawyer who initially represented former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson instructed her to downplay her knowledge of what happened during the Capitol insurrection. Cassidy Hutchinson told the House Select January 6th committee in testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. "We're going to downplay your role," attorney Stephen Passatino told Hutchinson, according to her testimony. "You were a secretary. The less you remember, the better." The details of the apparent Trump World pressure campaign on one of the committee's key witnesses were among a number of revelations and a handful of deposition transcripts the committee made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. The panel's final report, the closing salvo of its 18-month-long investigation, has not yet been released. Cassidy Hutchinson parted ways with Stephen Passantino after several Spring 2021 appearances before the committee, in which she felt she was giving untruthful or incomplete answers, she said. After switching attorneys, she provided some of the most dramatic live testimony of the panel's 9 hearings this year. According to Hutchinson, Passantino did not want her to tell the committee that former President Donald Trump had lunged at his security detail when they refused to take him to the Capitol during the riot on 6th of January 2021. Hutchinson felt she had no other option but to retain the Trump-aligned lawyer because she couldn't afford to pay the high costs of other attorneys she contacted while seeking representation, she told the committee in 2 days of depositions back in September. Stephen Passantino would not tell her who was paying for his legal services, Hutchinson told the committee, and she soon became leery, suspecting he was more concerned about Donald Trump and other high-ranking former White House officials than he was about her. I'm completely indebted to these people, she recalled telling her mother. I was like, and they will ruin my life, Mum, if I do anything that they don't want me to do. Pasantino encouraged her to downplay her role as one of former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' most trusted aides, she said, and urged her to answer questions with the phrase, I cannot recall, even when she had clear memories of what had happened. Cassidy Hutchinson said Stephen Pasantino and others in Donald Trump's orbit, including Mark Meadows, through an intermediary, kept reminding her to be loyal and repeatedly spoke of finding her a well-paid job after her interviews with the committee. We just want to focus on protecting the president. We all know you're loyal, Hutchinson said, Pasantino told her. In a statement first reported by CNN, Pasantino said he represented Hutchinson as he had other clients honorably, ethically, and fully consistent with her sole interests as she communicated them to me. Also released on Thursday, 22nd of December, were transcripts of the committee's interviews with Chris Krebs, former director of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Convicted January 6 rioter Stephen Ayers, former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Justice Department employee Ken Kulikowski, and Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary. Ken Kulikowski, whose transcript shows he told the committee he could not recall the answer to most of their questions, has connections to some of the most influential players in the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The Associated Press has also covered the same story. Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson described to the House January 6 committee a wide-ranging pressure campaign from Donald Trump's allies aimed at influencing her cooperation with Congress and stifling potentially damaging testimony about Trump. An extraordinary closed-door testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December, Cassidy Hutchinson recounted how those in the former president's circle dangled job opportunities and financial assistance as she was cooperating with the committee investigating the Capitol riot, and how her own lawyer, a former ethics counsel in the Trump White House, advised her against being fully forthcoming with lawmakers and told her, the less you remember, the better. The 9-member committee released 2 never-before-seen transcripts of Hutchinson's testimony as it tries to wrap up its investigation and make its work public. The committee, which will dissolve when Republicans take over the House of Representatives on 3rd of January, was also expected to release its final report on Thursday. The transcripts provide previously unknown details about what Cassidy Hutchinson called the moral struggle, torn between the desire to speak the truth and to remain loyal to Donald Trump, that she says she endured on the way to becoming one of the most memorable witnesses of the committee's investigation. In a televised hearing back in June, Hutchinson went public about Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021. She described his directive that magnetometers be removed from a rally of his supporters on that day and detailed his angry and ultimately rebuffed demands to be taken by the Secret Service to the Capitol to join the crowd trying to disrupt the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election victory. In my mind, this whole time, I felt this moral struggle, she said, according to the transcript. She described a first interview with the committee in which she concealed testimony about Donald Trump that, months later, she would deliver to a rapt hearing room. Looking back now, she said, it feels ridiculous because in my heart I knew where my loyalties lied, and my loyalties lied with the truth. And I never wanted to diverge from that. You know, I never wanted or thought that I would be the witness that I have become, because I thought that more people would be willing to speak out to. But to hear her tell it, the testimony was never a sure thing. Like other aides whose proximity to Donald Trump entangled them in investigations, Cassidy Hutchinson scrambled to find a lawyer after receiving a subpoena from the committee last year. Former White House officials and Trump allies worked to line up a lawyer for her, despite her own discomfort at being represented by someone in Trump world, an affiliation she feared would make her indebted to these people. She said she was contacted in February by Stephen Passantino, a former White House ethics counsel who told her he would be her lawyer. He said she would not have to pay for his services, but demurred when she asked from where the money was coming. She later learned that it was from Trump allies.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.